Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film World Podcast. I am your host, now and forever, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the former editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe. We are returning from a brief summer vacation hiatus to talk to you about issues in the culture or things that I'm interested in the culture. I'm going to start by talking to my trivia teammate and podcast contributor, Jessica Babbitt, about our recent epic triumph in the Jeopardy Bar League, the inaugural Jeopardy Bar League Pub Trivia Championship, where Jessica and I and some of our teammates emerged as the champions, the first ever champions. That was very exciting for us, and it'll be exciting for you to hear us talk about it. And I'm also going to talk to Stephen Garrett, as I often do, about some of the movies that have come out this summer. I'm going to discuss Supergirl, a extremely disappointing DC Cinematic Universe offering. It came out this summer, and Steven's going to talk about various movies, including a new Minions movie, a new Toy Story movie, a new Jackass movie, and whatever else has caught his fancy. But first, Jessica Babbitt is here, and we're going to talk about what it takes to win the Jeopardy Bar League. I didn't miss much while I was gone on my vacation, but I did miss playing pub trivia with my pub trivia team, post-Trebek Stress Disorder, particularly because post-Trebek Stress Disorder recently won the first ever National Jeopardy Bar League Championship, which is I consider it one of the great accomplishments of my long and illustrious life. And one of the person who I have most to thank for making this victory happen is Jessica Babbitt, who is a frequent contributor to this podcast and also my very frequent trivia teammate and was my co-captain during the Jeopardy Bar League experience. And she's here today to talk with me about our stunning victory.
Happy,
hello, Jessica.
Happy to be here. It was quite a stunning victory.
I have to say, it was a while. It happened like a few weeks ago now. As we're talking, it was like 6 weeks ago or mm-hmm. something or more that we won. But I'm still kind of like, they haven't thrown us a parade yet, although they are throwing us a party. I'm still kind of glowing about it.
It was very exciting. There wasn't even a point from about midway through the tournament where I thought, okay, we might win this whole thing. I know you felt differently at different points in our journey, but coming down to the very end, I was like, this might actually happen.
It's basically like you're playing with a team and you're playing a game of Jeopardy with 61 questions, but every team gets to answer every question and every team gets to bet on every daily double and every final Jeopardy. So it's not like regular Jeopardy where you can just, you know, gradually bludgeon your opponents. You have to just kind of keep rolling and everybody has the same shot at getting these questions right.
And because we're all former Jeopardy champions, former Jeopardy players on our team, we went in with a Jeopardy-based strategy, and we found out after our first game, maybe we have to adjust our strategy a little bit.
Right, meaning we were playing to win, but we weren't playing to get maximum points. But we found out after the first week, we did win our first week,
yes.
But we found out that like the only way to win the league, because there were going to be other teams that won every game, although in the end it turned out there were only a couple of teams in the country that did, the tiebreaker was total number of points accumulated. So the idea is to like save your daily doubles till as late in the game as possible and then bet everything you have every time.
Yes.
Because you're not just playing against the people in your venue, you're playing against every team everywhere in the country.
Yes, and that's the exciting part too, right? And how the strategy, everyone seemed to figure out the strategy gradually as the weeks went on. It kind of clued us in. We were kind of clued into it after playing our first game and seeing everyone else's scores from the first game. We were like, okay, we really have to rip it on every single daily double, every single final Jeopardy. It is double or nothing every single time. And it's fascinating how that just became the de rigueur strategy for pretty much anyone who was in contention for the title.
And I think that even in future seasons, you're going to have to do that. Although that strategy also led to, you know, teams falling on their faces very often. And by the end of the tournament, there were only a couple of teams left standing. But okay, but that aside, that's not even where the real drama was.
Nope, it's not. It was interpersonal.
Yeah, there were basically like there were a couple of things that happened. One, you know, as the weeks went on, the number of teams who could actually win, remain undefeated, was getting smaller and smaller. By the end of week five, it was down to like eight teams in the country. And we're talking about thousands of teams that are playing like in bars all over the country. Yes. So that's a pretty narrow field. There's a loophole, however, in that you can only play one game a week under your official team name. But that doesn't stop you from taking your team and going and playing other games under assumed names to try to knock out your opponents. And that's exactly what happened to us here in Austin, where we live. You know, we have, there's our team is comprised, in order to be on post-traumatic stress disorder, which I founded in 2013 and added Jessica to the roster after she beat me on Pop Culture Jeopardy a couple of years ago. I was like, never again am I going to play against someone that good. All right. So, and for some reason you were willing to be on my team. There's another rival team in Austin made up of not entirely former Jeopardy players, but mostly, and anyone who hasn't been on Jeopardy either will be or could
be. Absolutely.
They're super good. And I have like, I have a personal animus with a lot of people, as you know.
You do?
Like someone once said that writers are like collectors of serial resentments. Mm-hmm. And so like I have a lot of bitter rivalries, and I certainly have that in this case. Like this team and I, other team and I, certain members of it, and I just do not get along. Everyone likes Jess.
I like them too. That's the thing, is like I understand. I totally understand where everyone stands on each other in this group, the various webs of relationships that form. I like these people. I play trivia. Right, yeah, I play trivia with them in other venues. I like these people.
And I used to, but there was a schism. So there's a rivalry. Yes. Let's put it that way. Yes. Yes. Jessica, you're friendly. Everyone likes you. You like everyone. I'm not like that. I'm sort of a darker person.
But even being totally friendly with them, there's still a rivalry there, I would say, between our two teams. They wanted to beat us and we wanted to beat them. And I think that's fair.
Yeah, absolutely. And they tried to betray you and us by sneaking into our regular venue, slinking in at the last second.
Yeah, they did.
Without registering under a false name. And then, I mean, they gave us hell. I mean, it was tough, but fortunately, that week six, we had a full roster. Because a lot of weeks, it was just like you and me, or you and me and your husband, or you and me and my wife Regina. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, someone else would join us, but it was a lot of just you and I carrying the ball.
Yes.
This week, we had a full team of excellent players, and we smacked them down.
It was so exciting. Then, it was wonderful.
It was really exciting.
Yeah.
When they missed that final Jeopardy, and you know, the answer was Ian Fleming, and they said John Le Carré, even though we'd already gotten it right, we like literally laughed almost mockingly at them. It was so glorious. And they left. They slunk out of that bar. They looked defeated. And what was interesting was then they went out and played their actual game, and then they crapped the bed and lost. And then suddenly it was down to us and this team in Chicago that we thought had us beat. They were running up these insane scores week in and week out. We were, you know, hundreds of thousands of points behind them.
We even adjusted our strategy with the assumption that they would win. We thought, okay, maybe we don't go the all or nothing route every time, and we pursue, because there's a regional championship as well as the national championship. And we thought to ourselves, why don't we just pursue the regional championship instead of attempting to nip at the national championship title? And then we also fall flat on our faces at some point, because all we needed to do to win the regional championship was win the game. It didn't have to be a big score. Didn't have to be a big score. No. We just had to win the game. And we were confident that we could do that. But then everything changed, Neil.
Well, everything changed. We won in week seven. We usually play on a Thursday night, which is like basically the end. There's a couple of games on Saturday, but basically it's the end of the Jeopardy Bar League week. But the Chicago team, suburban Chicago, Flossmoor, Illinois, they play on Tuesday. I woke up Wednesday morning to see that they had lost.
The final week. They lost their final game.
And I called Jessica as soon as I got up, and we were very excited. But then we found out there was a controversy about the loss.
Yes.
Like the team was protesting their loss, because apparently these two teams that had never played showed up.
I read about this as well on the Jeopardy Reddit. It made it to the internet that there is a team, a man or potentially a team who went to that bar specifically to knock this team off the leaderboard.
And then that man and that team showed up in Austin.
They sure did, didn't they?
He did. He showed up in Austin that Thursday night. And he told us, apparently his team had lost in D.C. the first week. They finished second because of some drunken bad Final Jeopardy bet. So he felt like this belonged to him. And he told, what he said to us is he wanted to make sure there was a worthy champion.
I don't know about that, but I feel like that's a noble pursuit, but I don't think that's what.
I did get his contact information. He never really gave me the information. He claimed that the team in Chicago was just one guy who was sitting there with his wife who wasn't answering any questions. And he claimed, and I can't verify this, the controversy involved the host of the game and the bar feeding this guy answers because they wanted to win the first prize. First prize, as we found out, is a $2,000 bar tab party at your venue of choice. It's something that Jessica and I are going to be enjoying in a couple of weeks at our local VO313 pizzeria. I don't know. I can't verify this, but
it's speculation of one guy, and it's some very interesting gossip. We have no idea if this is true, but we do know that the lodgers of the protest were the host in the venue. So,
yeah, not the team. Know. Not the team. All right, so we beat this guy, and then we actually ended up tying another rival team the final week. They tied us exactly. Because we buzzed in faster overall, which is not something we'd been doing every week, we won. We won the game, and we won the title, and we are the first ever Jeopardy Bar League champions. Jessica, tell the people what we've won.
We have won an all-expense-paid trip to Culver City, California, to see a taping of Jeopardy on the Alex Trebek stage and meet the host of Jeopardy himself, Ken Jennings.
All right. Well, first of all, both you and I have been on all expense paid trips to Culver City a couple of times. Several times to either play Jeopardy or watch Jeopardy. I've also met Ken Jennings because I interviewed him once at the Texas Book Festival. But regardless, you and I, and possibly one of our teammates, are going to go. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know about you, Jess, but I have a kind of a backdoor strategy. I think it would be really a good promotion for the Jeopardy Bar League, which Jeopardy is clearly all in on. If they put some of the champions of the first Jeopardy Bar League on the show.
This is my husband's pet conspiracy theory. He does think that the intention was for the winner of Jeopardy Bar League to appear on Jeopardy as a promotion for Jeopardy Bar League. Now, it being us presents a wrinkle to the plan because we have both already been on Jeopardy. We are ineligible to appear again on regular season Jeopardy.
Right. But there's tournaments.
There are tournaments.
And you and I both are still playing. You know, you're much younger than I am, but you and I think are still both playing at a high enough level so that, you know, I don't think I would personally embarrass myself if I went on a Jeopardy tournament. I know you wouldn't.
We are elite players in terms of the quizzing world, which is deep and varied. I don't know where we stand in the top parts of that. We are not the top players with the flashcard decks and all of that who are just spending all this time recalling facts, preparing to recall facts. But in terms of Jeopardy and Jeopardy play, we are elite players. We're very good.
Yeah, top 1%. Yes. Of people who play, so why not? Put a couple of players who could give other players not necessarily win. There's lots of good Jeopardy players, but it would not be impossible to imagine that either of us could win a tournament game or get to a tournament final. I mean, or at least a semifinal. It's in our skill set, but also because I don't know if you realize this or not, Jessica, but you and I are first ever Jeopardy Bar League national champions.
You know what? This is the first time hearing that.
Yeah. So you know, it's a privilege. First of all, it's a privilege to play with you and to play with the whole team, and it's a privilege for everyone listening to the our insight. It must really be inspiring a lot of people. Our story.
I always love to hear about a niche community doing their interesting things hidden away from the public and the drama that ensues from a niche community. And hopefully, everyone listening today is thrilled to hear that there's drama in the trivia world.
It's not easy to win either. Like I said, like I formed this team in 2013, and Post-Trivec Stress Disorder has been grinding out national tournaments, both live and in bars for a long time, and has never finished higher than fifth or sixth or seventh. So like for me, this is the culmination of everything. And you know, I know you say you want to back away, but I think, you know, we're going to have to defend our title. I think Jeopardy wants us to.
They do want us to, actually. They have said that they want us to. So I would like to, and this goes back to kind of the way that I approached the whole tournament altogether, because Neil did not mention this earlier, but he also wanted to compete under an assumed name to try and pip some of the,
I had the idea, but Jessica is a good and moral person, kind of a Jiminy Cricket type. Yeah. And I feel like your general attitude, Jess, toward it, I think is what, you know, the attitude that we're going to do this in a spirit of fun and friendship.
Yes.
For instance, like you and I both, you know, love like reality shows. Absolutely. Like The Amazing Race. The team that wins The Amazing Race is not the most devious. It's the team that has the best attitude.
I agree. And I just think to myself, and I've said this many times throughout the competition and any time that we've all kind of played together, is I just want to have fun with my friends. I want to drink a couple glasses of wine. I want to eat some pizza, and I want to answer some questions, some trivia questions. And there are lots of different venues that we can do this. This is the one that we chose. The league championship structure was so much fun, and I loved doing that. And I didn't want to, the word I used for it is I thought that it felt like a little sweaty to really attempt to win through not illegal subversion, but some kind of like subterfuge, right? And I just wanted to play under our team name and have fun with my friends. And if we won, that would be amazing. And we would know that we did it the way that it was intended to be done. And we did do that. And I'm so proud of us that we were able to do that.
Doing things the right way is worth it in and of itself.
It was very rewarding. It was very rewarding. Yes. And no matter what, like this is obviously the best possible outcome, but no matter where we fell on the leaderboard at the end of it, I had a fabulous, fun 8 weeks of playing. And to finish at the top of the leaderboard was just very validating and gratifying. And just knowing that we did that without having to try any tactics or strategies, and we were just purely on our wits alone. I loved it.
We also ate a lot of cheese bread.
Oh, so much. So much.
Too much cheese bread. So much. Too much. Too much. And it was not as good as the cheese bread I just ate in Italy.
Yeah, I'm sure it was not.
In any case, Jess, I'll be seeing you at our party in a couple of weeks, and I guess we're going to LA later this summer.
I think we are. I think we're going on vacation together
with other people.
Right. Okay. I mean, I don't know that you needed to clarify that part, but yes, other people are going too.
We're going on vacation as a team.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Awesome. All right. Well, I will. I'll talk to you.
Bye, Neil. It was good to be here.
We're halfway through the summer movie season. The summer movie season that really kind of started in May with the release of Obsession and then Backrooms. And those are kind of the two biggest hits, surprise hits of the summer. But there, you know, there's the usual raft of studio franchise blockbusters that come out in June and July. And Stephen Garrett, our blockbuster chief film critic,
Stephen
is
from
here
the
today,
block.
To talk to me about some of these. I wanted to start, Stephen. I went to see Supergirl, the much maligned DC Cinematic Universe movie. As we're talking, I saw it yesterday. I was just out of town for a couple of weeks, so I missed the premiere of Supergirl. I know it sounds crazy, but like I would have been, my butt would have been in the seat on opening day of Supergirl, because I have like
It does. Well, I'm kind of a, that's a character that I really love. I'm kind of a stealth expert on the mythology and lore of superheroines. And in fact, I'm currently involved in this creative project where I'm using AI to help me write an epic superheroine comic book series. Yeah. So okay. I know. Sounds crazy, but it's what's happening with me, and right, and I'll admit it. So Supergirl, you know, is like it's like one of the lodestar comic book heroines, you know, alongside a few others, Wonder Woman, some of the Marvel comic heroines, but you know, Supergirl's a big one, and this was a kind of the second major DC cinematic universe movie that James Gunn had produced following Superman, and you know, it's a real dud. Supergirl.
Yeah, it's kind of sad to think. I had hopes. I mean, you know, her little spunky appearance in, you know, towards the end of Superman, it was delightful. And I was like, oh, this looks really fun. And it's her dog, Astra's, or not
Crypto.
Astra.
Crispo. Not Crispo. Crypto.
Astro is the Jetsons. Yeah,
and there's no fictional dog known as Crispo.
Crispo. Whatever.
The Crispo. Dog. The dog who works as a fry cook. No.
I was quite charmed by Millie Alcott. I did have somewhat high hopes, although the marketing trailers just made it look kind of like what was the thing he did for Marvel?
Guardians of the Galaxy.
It just looked like kind of like a Guardians flavored.
Okay, well, I actually saw the movie, and it does have that. it does have a Guardians. There are plenty of scenes of her like riding a space bus with next to rubbery alien creatures. There's a couple of like Star Wars cantina bar knockoff scenes with full of rubbery aliens, but it doesn't have the joy that Guardians of the and fun that Guardians of the Galaxy did. It tries to throw that stuff in there, but it's in service of this incredibly grim, dark story about addiction and childhood sex slavery and yeah, there's this band of internet of galactic brigands who like abduct girls and use them to propagate their race. I mean, they don't ever show the sex, but it's like, and this is what Supergirl, you know. But the problem is, Supergirl is not Supergirl in this. She's just, you know, Kara Zor-El traveling around in this spaceship, but like wearing like really not even like that fun trench coat she had in Superman, but just wearing like kind of like stoner clothes and just like vomiting constantly, and like, you know, her ship is a mess, and she's got alcoholic trauma, and it's not fun.
Messy.
She's
girl.
Messy.
Well, so is this an origin story for her becoming Supergirl?
Sort of, but she's already Supergirl when it starts. But then she goes off in space to get drunk because she's traumatized by the destruction of her home planet. And then in this movie she meets this like tween. Early teenager named Ruthie. This is based on a graphic novel from 2021 called Supergirl, Woman of Tomorrow. So it's not kind of like the fun gee whiz college girl Supergirl in a skirt that we grew up reading in DC Comics. It's like, but which is fine. I mean, that they did that movie with Helen Slater in 1984.
Faye Dunaway.
And Peter O'Toole. But and here's the thing about the 1984 Supergirl. I mean, it's a bad movie, but really bad.
Camp classic.
But for those of us who love superheroines, it's kind of iconic because Helen Slater is innocent and beautiful. She has a fun secret identity. You know, and she's always like having to find a way to like change into Supergirl and go save the day. Whereas Millie Alcock, who is perfectly good in this movie, she's a good actress and looks great in the costume when she actually wears it, which is not toward the end of the movie. You know, it doesn't have any of that same wonder, that fun. There's references to her being good, but she's constantly beating the crap out of people and killing people, taking revenge. You know, the first line she says. After she puts on the Supergirl costume, she goes, turns to the bad guy and says, "I'm the bitch whose dog you hurt." And I'm like, that's just not the...
That's a classic line. That's an iconic DC line.
But I'm like, it's just not right for that part. You know, it's like, "I'm the bitch whose dog you hurt." I'm like, who, you know, I'm like, you know, superheroines need to be strong and feminist, and they need to, you know, show girls and women that you can have power and take control of your own destiny. But they also have to be appealing and sexy to men. I'm sorry, they do. You know, you can't just put a movie out about superheroes and try to reach only like an audience of like, you know, angry semiotics majors from Brown. And I'm sorry, you know, it's like Supergirl is independent and her own thing and is funny and feisty, but she's also got to be sexy. And she's not in this movie. And I know I'm male gazing it, but I don't care. Like, I have a man. I have a male gaze. And I want to...
You're male glazing. I want
to see Supergirl flying around. And it's all... And also, the needle drops are terrible. Like, the final fight scene, the needle drop, it's a female sung cover version of that song, The Middle. And it's so murky. Oh, it's so bad, that end needle drop. And the thing is, like, there's a version of this movie that's good. Like, there's a little bit of an origin flashback to showing the destruction of Supergirl's home planet, which is, I thought, pretty well rendered. There's a few scenes here and there where David Corenswet shows up as Superman with his kind of gee-whiz attitude that I'm like, oh, well, that's what we're actually looking for in this movie, not like...
Apparently.
Yeah, punk, right. He's super... Well, that's the thing. It's like going for... Avril Lavigne is more punk than Supergirl.
Wait. Okay, so there are two interesting things that Well, the first is what you said, which is that she's traumatized by the destruction of Krypton.
But who isn't?
I think that's kind of... That's an interesting take that you don't really see. I mean, Superman is well-adjusted because he had good parents.
In Smallville.
She clearly did not have that. And it's kind of messed her up in a really interesting way. There was something else that I read from another... I think it was in the New York Times, the reviewer there. No, it was IndieWire. But she said, you know what's great about that? She's like, in defense of Supergirl, this is a superhero movie where the stakes are not the entire universe. The stakes are actually much lower. And, it's not like all of humanity is going to,
sure.
It's going to go at the Thanos. That's... Which they kind of appreciated. They're like, take it down a little bit, make the stakes a little more modest. It sounds like sex trafficking is not modest, but at least it's something different, which I have to admire.
But it's not fun. It's not fun to watch. No, that's the thing. No. It's like, yes. And just the script is poorly paced. A lot of the side, they have Jason Momoa pops in again, and he was good as Aquaman, but he was not physically correct for the role. Aquaman should be a blonde weirdo in an orange suit. But he plays Lobo, who's like an interstellar bounty hunter, and he's perfect for that part. But he just shows up, and Supergirl's like, oh, that's Lobo. And then we have to watch Lobo do Lobo things, but he's not really integrated. And the story is poorly done. The villain, played by this actor named Matthias Schoenaerts, is ugly and
Oh, I like that actor.
Yeah, but he's ugly and he's unappealing and he's not interesting. He's not charismatic. He's not funny. It's not good. That's the thing. The movie just isn't good. I mean, you can argue its place in this. It's not the worst superhero movie ever made. There have been plenty of others that are way worse. But I think the character can continue given sort of more. I feel like character needs a little bit more wholesome material. I know I hate to say it, From here they need to just incorporate her into an ensemble, And I think it's fine that way. I don't. The movie didn't do well at the box office, so I don't see that they're not rushing to make a sequel. It's a weird misfire for DC because like they had some goodwill coming out of that Superman movie, and this is just kind of a strange, misguided path that they took. But I mean, I don't think it's not a franchise-ending disaster, but. It is not a good entry into the canon. So let's talk about...
Not so super.
Not so super. So let's talk about what you've been up to. You've reviewed a bunch of movies for us. You reviewed a couple of kids, Toy Story 5, Minions and Monsters, which I read your take on that. I was like, oh, this is a weird movie. And then the new Jackass movie, which I guess is for a certain kind of kid as well.
That's right. Everybody gets kicked in the crotch in all these movies.
Ow my balls.
There's
crotch kicking in Toy Story 5?
Not as much as I'd like. But there are a lot of toys
And there's also poop jokes.
Okay.
You know, Jackass has a lot of poop jokes, and in Toy Story 5, there is a toy that is meant to help kids potty train, and that is voiced by Conan O'Brien.
Oh.
And, yeah, I think, like, my big beef with... they're fine. Toy Story 5 is fine. Minions is fine. They kind of wear out their welcome, and I don't know if they do what they are intending to do. I don't know what Minions is trying to do, but... Toy Story 5 is trying to tell some story about technology. Sure. And I think for the first 20 minutes, it is so sharp and funny because it is simultaneously showing the hysteria and the true numbingness of, you know, looking at tablets, especially as, you know, as a young child, and how alienating it can be, because there's this great shot of the whole neighborhood at night and the household windows are lit up by the glow of screens.
Yeah.
And, you know, different people are in different rooms just not talking to each other. And I think that's an excellent, wonderful thing that they should explore. And at the same time, the hysteria of the analog toys towards the digital is a wonderful kind of parody of the hysteria that people feel towards a technology. So you think, okay, we're in good hands. They're going to tell us maybe a more nuanced story than... you know, just like slamming it. Because, of course, Disney is expecting all of these audience members to be looking at their tablets watching Toy Story 5 in 6 months when it's released, right? And when it's on the Disney
right.
Plus.
Herein lies the irony. So yeah.
Well, this is the irony. And frankly, it's not that ironic because they don't bite the hand that feeds. They don't really have anything serious to say about these technologies other than, no, play with some more analog toys. Don't forget your cowgirl.
Yeah.
Don't forget your dinosaur.
Yeah, don't forget.
So they kind of punt. I think it's a you know, they don't really go too far into it in a way that could be really meaningful. Aside from they dip their toe into a little bit of social media girl hazing, which I think is admirable, but they don't really do more than just like, hey, guess what? You know, if you just play in the backyard with a new friend, that's going to be more meaningful than y'all, you know, kind of like sharing stuff on.
All right, so I wanted to talk about Minions and Monsters. It looked like, I mean, I couldn't bear to actually go see this. This is not a franchise I like at all, but it looked like it's like a tribute to old Hollywood in some ways, like classic Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, like, I think that it starts out very promising, and then it kind of falls apart and becomes a pretty generic and chaotic attack of monsters with Minions, mm-hmm. you know, trying to... overcome the chaos that they automatically and naturally generate around them. Because the Minions are funny that way, right? Like, they're actually, they are evil to the extent to which that they want to serve an evil overlord. And the running joke, and there was a previous, aside from the Despicable Me movies and prequels, there is a Minions movie called Minions that depicts them, you know, through the ages, because they apparently they're immortal, so they're in every stage of history, almost like, you know, Peabody and...
Sherman.
Was it Mr. Peabody? Sherman, yeah. Mr. Peabody, yeah. Stepping through time. And that's kind of cute, because they're looking for bad bosses to serve, and yet they keep kind of accidentally, at least in this movie, sabotaging it. There's one specific minion who keeps kind of tripping over his ball sack, so to speak, and... they accidentally kind of kill their overlords or neutralize them in certain ways, and then they have to move on and find new ones. Anyway, none of it makes sense, but they're all, like, strung together sight gags that are kind of funny, little, you know, little bits. It's like sketch comedy, right? And then they somehow end up in Los Angeles in 1920, and, of course...
Do they serve Fatty Arbuckle?
They don't. They don't have any Coke bottles or any Fatty Arbuckle encounters. There is a brief look at a party that looks like it came out of Damien Chazelle's Babylon, but there are no dead whores or anything like that. Or
I wouldn't expect. I wouldn't expect dead whores in a Minions movie.
I don't know, man. It's getting edgy. Your Supergirl seemed pretty dark with sex trafficking, so maybe it's a matter of time. But this Minions and Monsters it's cute. The silent film stuff is adorable. It's really fun, and it's great to see shout-outs to. I mean, and I was annoying my wife, who actually loves the Minions, but I was like, you know, I bet this is going to be a Safety Last reference. I bet this is Sherlock you know, junior or whatever.
And she's like, is it too late for me to marry that other guy?
Yeah, exactly. She's like, you're so annoying. So that's really fun to see all the, like, the silent film stars get their shout outs. And but then they do that thing where it's like, yes, this is the 1920s. And, oh, sound is introduced. And then suddenly they're making, like, parodies of, like, Humphrey Bogart movies. Mm. And you're just like, okay, none of this makes sense at all. Like, now you're just throwing in, like, hooray for Hollywood nonsense.
Yeah. All right.
You know, and it falls apart.
Speaking of getting hit in the ball sack, I read your Jackass. What's this last one called? Jackass One Last Jack?
Best and Last.
Best and Last. I'm like, this guy really knows a lot about the Jackass franchise. I mean, you were really, you showed, I mean, I don't know if you did a Wikipedia search before you wrote your review, but you showed like some deep canonical knowledge of the,
thank you. I try to bring my, you know, if I'm writing something, I want to at least look like I know what I'm talking about. I saw the first Jackass. I watched the show kind of sporadically and it was fun, you know, and I definitely laughed. There's some good pranks, which are called back in this movie, which is basically a highlight.
Yeah.
You know, it kind of reminded me of That's Entertainment.
Ah, yeah, of course.
Whereas, like, That's Entertainment was a clip reel of, like, great moments, and you're like, this is good. And then they made a sequel, and you're like, sure. And then they did number three, and you're like, why are you still doing this? Like, this is tired.
Right.
These are the scraps. Right. And this is a little bit of
a scrap. So they don't do a lot of, they don't do a lot of new stunts, then.
They do a couple new stunts, but honestly, and they even make a point of this in the movie, like, they're all in their 50s. Yeah. And frankly, I don't think they can, like, Johnny Knoxville is like, I cannot do any more concussions, like, stunts. Yeah. And the funny thing about Jackass is that, first of all, the stunt work is actually pretty impressive, right? And I love movies with stunts. I also love people who are just punching themselves in the face. I think that's really funny. Like, there's one thing, you know, it's one thing to do a prank on somebody who doesn't want it. That just comes off as cruel and mean. But if they're just doing it to themselves and each other, I think it's like, you know, a bunch of, like, idiots roughhouse, yeah. You know? But they've had too many concussions. They can't do, Johnny Knoxville for sure can't do anything more than, there's a lot of, like, there are a lot of butt jokes, yeah. Because people are getting, like,
colonoscopies.
You know, colonoscopies, yeah. and proctologies, yeah. And things like that. So, which is age appropriate, and which they're still able to do. Apparently, they just don't have any sensitivity in their gonads anymore because they punch themselves so often. But there's a lot of punishment to the groin and to the ass in this movie. But not to the head.
Which seems appropriate to the 50s, your 50s.
It's age appropriate, yeah. and it's very sentimental. Like, Johnny Knoxville gets a little teary-eyed, you know, because it's all kind of like, you know, time marches on and they're too old for this, you know? So it's fun. They, you know, maybe a dip one too many time in the well to get some Jackass.
But we're not too old to go to the movies. That's the one hobby that I think. In fact, the older you get, the better it is to go to the movies. And next week, Stephen,
it sometimes hurts your ass if the movies.
Sometimes.
And it sometimes feels like you get kicked in the head if you see a movie like Supergirl.
Apparently. The way you do it. But next week is one of those. Get ready, everyone. This is one of those marquee weeks that you wait for. Christopher Nolan's The Odyssey is coming. I came home from Italy after 2.5 weeks, and my dog, it took her 24 hours to recognize me. So.
Oh, it's been too long. Yeah, but it was like you were away for 10 years.
She recognized me, and then she fell asleep on my yoga mat. But The Odyssey is coming. Stephen and I will be talking about it in our next episode. Please tune in for that. Stephen, get ready. Get ready to steer through.
I'm buying my Cliff Notes right now, and boy, if you thought I knew a lot about Jackass in that review, I'm going to really try my hard to make it seem like I know what I'm talking about.
I'm going to know you're faking it. But then,
I got a bone up. I got a bone up.
So to speak. All right, I'll talk to you later, Stephen.
All right, bye.
All right, thank you so much, Stephen Garrett. All the movies that Stephen and I talked about are either in theaters now or are just out of theaters and are going to be on streaming soon. Catch them if you like. There's nothing essential here, just various bits of pop culture effluvia that we caught in the middle of our summers. Also, thanks so much to Jessica Babbitt. Congratulations, as always, to Jessica. We did it. We won the Jeopardy Bar League. Jessica and I will be journeying to Los Angeles later this year to tour the set of Jeopardy and try to talk to them to letting us back
on the show. I am Neil Pollack. I am the greatest living American writer. I am the host of this show, the Book and Film Globe podcast. Our theme song and incidental music, which are relatively new here, are by composer Matthew Sheffer and licensed for use by Sea of Reeds Media. All rights reserved. Thank you so much for listening, and I will talk to you soon.
Original production.